The wit and wisdom of Will Rogers, one of the most beloved entertainers in American history. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
We've saddled bucking broncos, 1,000 steers we tamed.
We've killed so many Indians, I almost feel ashamed.
We've had fame thrust upon us by yellow magazines.
And now I am a model for the moving picture machine.
The 5 and 10 cent powders all want us on their screen. We're two grand cowboys with guns and lariats. We frighten many people, you may find some running yet. They know we're pony, blind the way we dress. We are two new grand cowboys from the wild and woolly west.
We're two grand cowboys with guns and lariats. We frighten many people, you may find some running yet. They know we're phony, from the way we dress. We are two dude ranch cowboys from the wild and woolly east.
That's what the radio wants is good singing.
You bet that's
what they want. That's why they've been tuning in year after year, hoping that someday they'd get it.
Well, they got it tonight, I'll tell you.
Still, you're not taking this singing that we just did serious, are you?
Any singing that I do, I'm taking serious, I'll tell you that.
Yes, sir. What are you doing out here, anyhow? Did you come out to California to go in the movies?
No, Bill. I don't want to go in the movies.
No? I never heard of anybody coming to California didn't want to go in the movies, you know? Didn't somebody ever tell you that you looked like somebody that was in the movies? Looked like Durandy or somebody?
No, Bill, somebody... You see, a fella bought a round-trip ticket out here, and he didn't use it. And I came out here to use the ticket.
Come clear out here just to use the other end of a round-trip ticket?
Well, he didn't use either end.
Oh.
He just bought it to have a joke on California.
Well, that was a good joke on California. That's a good joke on the railroads, too, you know.
I thought maybe you'd come out here with all these governors. There's been a terrible mess of governors out here lately. And they've been out here on their vacation.
Whose vacation?
Their state?
Say, Bill, you helped herd them, didn't you?
Yeah, they were... Did you ever herd a governor?
Well, no and yes. I herded sheep once in Wyoming. It's just the same thing, ain't it?
Well, yes and no.
Herding Democratic governors is just like herding sheep. But herding Republican governors is more like goats.
Well, it was mighty fine of the Democratic ones to let those goats trail along with them that way. How many goats was there in there, Bill?
Well, there was only three. There was California's governor, Nevada's governor, and New Hampshire. You see, there's only really 7 Republican governors in all captivity.
Well, why do they keep those 7? Shouldn't Democrats have those jobs? Does Post Office Farley know they're stealing them?
Well, they just keep them kind of as an exhibit, I think. They just use Republicans nowadays, mostly just in the circuses and zoos.
Say, now you're out here, I want to do all that I can to show you around on your little visit. You want to go around and see all the movie people? I can introduce you to all of them that I know or any of them. I can have you meet everybody but Greta Garbo. Of course, there is no such person as Greta Garbo.
No?
No, didn't you know that?
No.
Oh, no, there's no Greta Garbo. Marlene Dietrich plays both parts.
Sure. All right. Anybody that knows anything knows that, you know. Well, that's just a trade name. It's a fake thing that they put over, you know. Still, there's people coming out here looking for it. I'll have you meet Dietrich, you know. You like to see a woman with man's britches on?
No, Bill, if it's all the same to you, I'd rather meet this woman that's had so much, her name in the paper so much. Amy McPherson.
Now, look here. Let me have you meet little Janet Gaynor, an awful sweet little girl, you know. Janet Gaynor, our little Lillian Harvey, you know, made that wonderful picture, Congress Dances.
Oh, say, I've been to Washington, and I've seen them congressmen. I never saw one could dance yet.
Oh,
I mean European Congress, not our Congress.
Oh,
I'm talking about Europe.
I thought you meant our bunch, you know. All they can do is sit their dances out and just talk.
Now, look here. I'll have you meet Clara Bowe. Hey, Clara Bowe, real ranch girl. You'd like Clara, you know. She's a real cowgirl. Got callus on her fingers just from milking.
I don't like milk. I'm a 3 2% man. I want to see Amy.
Now, look here. I'm going to have you meet Marie Dressler. Great girl, Marie Dressler.
Say, I knew Marie Dressler before the Hollywood actor had his own first swimming pool. Bill, I want to see him.
Now, let me show... Say, I'll show you Blue Boy. Best actor in Hollywood, old Blue Boy. Boy, took the prize at the Iowa State Fair 2 years. Real star, old Blue Boy.
I've been looking at ham actors all my life.
I know. But old Blue Boy is the biggest ham what am.
Well, when a hog is the best actor in Hollywood, I still want to see Amy.
Now, look here. I'll have you meet our mayor. You remember our ex-mayor that wouldn't touch the champagne to his lips and drink a toast to France? I'll have you meet him.
What's the matter with him? Couldn't he trust himself with it that close to his lips?
Peggy Joyce just landed here. You want to meet Peggy?
I don't want to marry.
Hey, Bill.
If you can fix it with Amy, I might do business with you.
Now, look here. All right, tonight, Sunday night. I'll tell you what I'll do. We'll go down to the tabernacle tonight. And I'll tell you what you have to do if you go down there. She baptizes you. You know that, don't you? You got a bathing suit?
No, I haven't got a bathing suit.
Well, that just that. They'll just have to sprinkle you then. That's all. All you can be is a Methodist. Fred?
Now, Fred, I'll tell you what you better do. You better tell these people what you're really doing out here in California.
Well, Bill, you see, I came out here with a new code for broadcasting over the radio.
Oh, new code. That's what we want to know about these new codes.
Yeah,
what is this new
code? We're going to cut down on the hours.
Yeah, how are you going to do it?
Well, we're going to make the announcer quit telling what his product will do.
Yeah.
He will tell who's going to pay for the program, you know? And then you got to buy the stuff and find out for yourself what it is.
Yes, that's a great idea. That's great. You know, then these mouthwash people can't go on there and tell you that it'll cure dandruff.
No, that's it. You see, Bill, as it is now, anything will do everything that the announcer can think of.
Well, sure. I tuned in on some coffee the other night. Some Chase's National Bank and somebody's coffee, and they told about it curing warts and moles and lifting a double chin and reducing Kate Smith.
Yes, sir.
And what are we going to do from there? I forgot what we're going to do there. we're going to.
Well, Bill, you know the comedians over the radio?
Yeah, you say we got to do something about the comedians. I wanted to forget about them.
Yeah.
What's the code to shorten the comedians?
Well, we're going to cut out his funds.
Oh, yeah.
And when you cut out a radio comedian's funds, you cut his time down 90%.
Now, what are you going to do about the crooner? What's the code for the crooner?
Well, we got a code to discourage the crooner.
You can't discourage the crooner. No. Crooning is a disease. It's brought on by an asthmatic condition of the thorax. And the minute the crooner sees a microphone, he has a relapse.
Well, our code will discourage it.
How are you going to discourage it?
We shoot him after the first verse.
Well, who's going to see you?
Well, the ex-soldiers. That gives them work and also business.
What are you going to do about shortening the hours of these Chambers of Commerce speeches and mayor speeches over the radio? What's the code for them?
Well, we're going to have a microphone, and it'll be dead. And they're going to talk into that. They'll talk to themselves.
Oh.
That's great.
What are you going to do with this guy that tells all these lies on the radio, this Jack Pearl? What are you going to do about him?
Well, we'll put him with the political speakers where he belongs.
Well, what are you going to do with this guy that comes on the radio every once in a while and says, all I know is what I read in the papers and blathers around and about everything that he don't know anything about? What are you going to do to choke him off?
Well, we're going to let the people do with him the same as they've always done with him. Tune him out the minute he starts.
Oh, what? Hey, you rubbed that in on me. Oh, that's what they've been doing with this guy. Say, I don't want to bring up anything unpleasant, but do you remember one summer on Long Island many years ago when you and I got ambitious and tried to put out a little circus and wild west?
Yeah, we didn't get very far with it, did we, Bill?
We got so far with it, we liked it, I got back with it. I remember that. Remember that. All I can remember of that thing is a little song that we composed after we got the little show back home. You remember it?
Travel, travel, little star, in your one-horse circus car. Each policeman you get by must have cinders in his eye. Lots of fame attached to you, sheriffs have attachments too. How they'll wonder where you are. Travel! Audience we opened to, his beard was long and black. He said, I want my money back. We told him we would beat him if he made another crack. We beat him to the railroad track. The cattle swung our elephant, and he attached his trunk, and the elephant attached his trunk to him. They're looking for that sheriff yet. When last thing he was drunk, our sheriff with a wooden leg named Jim. But we don't know what they want his other limb. Travel, travel, little star, in your one-horse checkered car. Each policeman you get by must have scissors in his eye. Lots of favors packed to you. Sheriff, have an attachment too. How they'll wonder where you are. Travel.
From the 13th of August, 1933 broadcast of The Golf Show, Will Rogers and guest Fred Stone. Rogers, who had been born in what was then Indian Territory in 1879, it is now part of Oklahoma, was one of the most talented human beings ever to set foot on an American stage. He was, at various times, a vaudeville comic, a rodeo star, a newspaper columnist, a movie star, a philosopher, a best-selling author, a populist political activist, and the highest-paid performer in network radio. The McNaught Press Syndicate, which distributed his newspaper column, which Rogers started in 1922, paid him $10,000 a month to write them. And both the CBS and NBC Blue radio networks paid him $500 per minute for a weekly 15-minute spot on The Golf Show. In the 21st century, many have never heard of Will Rogers, let alone heard the man's voice, or even know his best-remembered line, "Never met a man I didn't like." That, by the way, is the title of a fairly good book on Rogers' life and writings by Joseph H. Carter. You may want to pick up a copy. It seemed, however, that in the 1930s, there wasn't a person on the planet who didn't like Will Rogers, except maybe for that darn fool in Germany named Hitler. When Rogers died, it was front page news in Japan and the Soviet Union, as well as the United States. Will Rogers was, simply put, the best known and best liked American of his time. What gained him his initial fame was his ability to speak plainly but comically about current events in his stage act. In 1915 and 1916, Rogers starred in Flo Ziegfeld's Midnight Frolic and Ziegfeld Follies on Broadway, alongside W.C. Fields, Burt Williams, and Fanny Brice, making one of the earliest racially integrated casts of stars in New York stage history. At the time, automobile manufacturer Henry Ford was making an attempt to end the Great War then being waged in Europe, about which Rogers made a few memorable comments. By 1923, many of Rogers' stage comments about Ford still seemed topical and the rest easily adaptable to post-war America, so he recorded them for the Victor Record Company under the title Will Rogers Nominates Henry Ford for President.
Toastmaster, gentlemen, you too, politicians. The Democrats are the middle-of-the-road party. The Republicans are the straddle of the road party. So I hereby nominate Mr. Henry Ford for president and christen the party the All Over the Road Party. In the first place, it's too bad he is so competent. That is the only thing that'll beat him. Mr. Ford's a good friend of mine, and years ago, he overlooked a suggestion that would have made him immortal. It was when he went over to stop the war. I wanted him to take the girls we had in the Follies and let them wear the same costumes they wore in the show and march them down between the trenches. Believe me, the boys would have been out before Christmas. He has made more money than any man in the world by paying the highest wages. Yet, he don't even manufacture necessities. Neither would you call it a luxury. It just kind of comes under the heading of knick-knacks. I was at his home last year and happened to ask him that in case of stiff opposition, just how cheap he could sell his car. He said, "Why, Will, by controlling the selling of the parts, I could give the cars away." He said, "Why, those things will shake off enough bolts in a year to pay for themselves. Second year, that's just pure profit." People think Dr. Cooley was the originator of auto suggestion, but Mr. Ford is. He originated all those suggestions when he made the synopsis of a car. He has just recently lowered the price, $50. That's done to discourage thievery. He is the first man that ever took a joke and made it practical. So let's let him take this country. Maybe he can repeat. He should make a good political race, if he carries 2/3 of this country now. There's no reason why there shouldn't be a Ford in the White House or everywhere else. He's the only man that could make Congress earn their salaries. He would start a bill through and give each one something to tack on to it. When it come out, it would be ready to use. He is the only man that when Congress started stalling could lift up the hood and see what is the matter with it. Some are against him because he don't know history. What we need in there is a man that can make history, not recite it. Now, if Mr. Ford will just take another one of my suggestions, he can be elected. If he will just make one speech and say, "Voters, if I am elected, I will change the front on them."
All of this is hardly to say Will Rogers could not be sharply critical of an injustice. His old vaudeville friend turned movie comic, Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, was arguably the most popular film comic in the world by Labor Day week of 1921, when he was falsely accused of rape and manslaughter in the death of actress Virginia Rappe. What had happened was that Rappe had undergone a botched abortion in San Francisco and then crashed the party at the St. Francis Hotel being held that weekend by Arbuckle, where Rappe fell critically ill. Rappe also suffered from a number of sexual diseases simultaneously, none of which Arbuckle ever contracted in his life. Rappe died several days after Arbuckle returned to Hollywood, during which time an associate of Rappe's hatched a blackmail scheme, which was in turn seized upon by the politically ambitious district attorney of San Francisco, one Matthew Brady. Add the San Francisco-based fraudulent journalism of the Hearst newspaper chain, always hungry for a Hollywood scandal to exploit, and you had a political and media campaign that wrecked Arbuckle's career with its lies. By Easter 1922, Arbuckle had been acquitted with an apology, rather extraordinary, by the jury that acquitted him. But Arbuckle was banned from making movies in Hollywood. Rogers had directly profited from Arbuckle's troubles. The role in a film to be titled The Melancholy Spirit, which Paramount originally cast with Arbuckle as the star, was rewritten and recast for Rogers instead. But Rogers was the most vocal supporter Arbuckle had in his slow rebuilding of his career. When Arbuckle suffered a fatal heart attack in 1934, Rogers wrote a glowing memorial tribute to his old friend and sharply chastised those who contributed to, in Rogers' phrasing, borrowed from mutual friend Buster Keaton, the end of one of America's greatest clowns from a broken heart. Rogers was also called upon to appear on special broadcasts, and the unemployment relief program of October 13, 1931 was no exception. Carried on both the CBS and NBC Red and Blue networks, it was a broadcast urging America's haves to help out America's have-nots as the Great Depression hit its lowest point. Will Rogers was not smiling that night, and his comments were as bitter an indictment of the American way of business as have ever been broadcast on commercial radio.
Don't get scared in stuffy radios, huh? I'm not advertising or trying to sell you anything. Now, Mr. Owen Young asked me to annoy on this program this evening. You all know Mr. Owen D. Young, you know? He's the only sole surviving wealthy Democrat. Well, Mr. Young, he's head of the Young Plan, you know? He's the originator of the Young Financial European Plan. He's the head of a Young Men's Temperance Union and originator of Young's Markets and Young Kippa. And was the first Democratic child born of white parents in Youngstown, Ohio. He started the Young Plan in Europe. That was that every nation pay just according to what they could afford to pay, see? And, well, somebody else come along with an older plan than Young's plan, and it was that nobody don't pay anybody anything. And, of course, that's the oldest plan there is. And that's the one they're working under now. That's why we ain't getting anything from Europe. We're reading the papers every day, they get us all excited over to one or a dozen different problems that's supposed to be before this country. There's not really but one problem before the whole country at this time. It's not the balancing of Mr. Mellon's budget. That's his worry. That ain't ours. And it's not the League of Nations that we read so much about. Or it's not the silver question. The only problem that confronts this country today is that at least 7 million people are out of work. That's our only problem. There is no other one before us at all. It's to see that every man that wants to, able to work, is allowed to find a place to go to work. Prohibition, we hear a lot about that. Well, that's nothing to compare to your neighbor's children that are hungry. It's food. It ain't drink that we're worried about today. Here a few years ago, we were so afraid that the poor people were liable to take a drink that now we've fixed so they can't even get something to eat. So here we are in a country with more wheat and more corn and more money in the bank and more cotton, more everything in the world. There's not a product that you can name that we haven't got more of it than any country ever had in the face of the earth. And yet we've got people starving. We'll hold the distinction of being the only nation in the history of the world that ever went to the poorhouse in an automobile. The potter's field are lined with granaries full of grain. Now, if there ain't something cockeyed in an arrangement like that, then this microphone here in front of me is, well, it's a cuspidor, that's all. I don't suppose there's the most unemployed or the hungriest man in America has contributed in some way to the wealth of every millionaire in America. It wasn't the working class that brought this condition on at all. It was the big boys themselves who thought that this financial drunk we were going through was going to last forever. They over-merged and over-capitalized and over everything else. That's the fix that we're in now. Now, I think that every town and every city will raise this money. In fact, they can't afford not to. They've got the money because there's as much money in the country as there ever was. Only the fewer people have it, but it's there. And I think the towns will all raise it, because I've been on a good many charity affairs all over the country, and I have yet to see a town or a city ever fail to raise the money when they knew the need was there and they saw the necessity. Every one of them will come through. Europe don't like us, and they think we're arrogant and bad manners, and have a million faults, but every one of them, they give us credit for being liberal. Doggone it, our people are liberal. I don't know about America being fundamentally sound and all that after-dinner hooey, but I do know that America is fundamentally liberal.
Another of Will Rogers' most famous quotes was, "I belong to no organized party. I am a Democrat." The Democratic Party certainly looked very disorganized when they went to Chicago for their 1932 National Convention, but before they finally agreed on the ticket and nominated Governor Franklin Roosevelt of New York for president, Rogers addressed the convention and wrapped up his remarks thusly.
Do me a favor, Forquist. When you leave, now some of you are going to be disappointed. Some of you come here for your candidate, and your heart and soul is set on your candidate. Now, for God's sake, do this thing for us, will you? When, no matter who they nominate, somebody, a lot of you are going to be disappointed. But for the Lord's sake, for once in your life, go home. Don't act like Democrats. Act like he was the man you come here to see nominated. Dadgummit, get out of there. By golly, you'll be there. Anyone. Don't go home sore and say we nominated the weakest man and we can't win with him. You don't know whether he'll be the weakest man. The man you think will be the weakest man, if they nominate him, you don't know it till next November. Boy, they couldn't. I don't see how they could possibly be a weak enough man not to win in November. I don't know how he could be so weak. God, if he lives, if he lives till next November, he's in, that's all. So just get some cards. And now, I'm going to quit. I'm going to leave you all. And I know comedy is no novelty on this rostrum. It's a shame. It's a terrible thing for a comedian to get up here and have to follow what I have. But I will say that this is the only intentional comedy that's been here. You know what I mean? I mean, mine is meant to be foolish. But listen, do go home now. I don't know. Now, everybody makes fun of us with our convention. Say, look at them fool Democrats. Get there and act a fool, they'll be there for a month and fight and argue. Now, the people don't know. They don't know it. You know why we have so much fun at our conventions, you know? Because heretofore, we've always had fun at our conventions because we knew we wasn't going anywhere else. You know what I mean? That was the last... Now, but listen, I showed up, folks. Please do this. When they nominate, when they bring in the platform, don't argue too much over it, because they ain't going to live by it nohow. You know what I mean? Nobody's going to live by it. It ain't going to ever be read anymore. Don't take it serious. I mean, it's just for the orator to get up and point to and all. So don't mess with the platform. When it comes to your candidates, do the best you can for him. Stay with him as long as you... can rightfully do so, but when they nominate the other fella, dadgum you, if you'll get together and go home and quit messing around with, you know, and fighting among yourselves, you got a good chance. Now do that, will you? Goodbye and good luck to you.
You know, an awful lot of our letters that we get from people, they seem to kind of resent the audience that is present. They say, we want to hear. We don't want to hear them laugh and applaud. Now the question arises, is it better to broadcast with or without an audience? Of course, I'm speaking now from the comedian's angle, not the singer or
bands or public speaker or anything. But the comedian, what is the public's reaction to the comedian, with or without an audience? Do they want to sit quietly at home and listen to what we have to say and figure out for yourself whether it's funny or amusing or mildly entertaining or boring or whatever it is? Or do you folks want to take your cue from an invisible audience that you don't see, take your cue from them, you know, when to laugh?
Helps us, you know, and gives us a little encouragement, and Lord knows we need it. But does it bore you? That's what we want to know, for you're the one that has to do the listening, and you should have it, you know, served to you like you want it, whether you want it raw, medium, or well done, or whatever you want. You see, any comedian has dozens of tricks and mannerisms and facial antics that we can get a laugh on from an audience that can see them. But it's naturally lost to you. And about half the time, you wonder what the laugh is all about. You say, am I dumb? Did I miss something? Well, maybe you did, but it was because you just couldn't see it, that was all. We was maybe turning a somersault or wiggling our ears or thumbing our nose or putting our big toe in our mouth or doing some other marvelously clever trick, which we use in a pinch. And then, too, most comedians are... Well, they're just funny to look at, you know. They have some odd defect of the face or just plain homely. Unfortunately, I'm about the only one that's not. Tenor, Wynn, Pearl, Benny, Cantor. In fact, any of them that you can mention, well, you have to laugh when you just look at them. They're just odd looking. While with me, you would say, who is that distinguished looking man walking toward the microphone? While they command immediate laughter by simply doing nothing, I command a kind of a hushed attention, rather an awe, you know. Immediately you say, there's a man with a message. While theirs is an infectious laugh or a smile, mine is of learning, of culture, of quiet dignity. You would say, there's a brain trust. Now, here's another secret about the studio audience. It's people that particularly like you. You know what I mean? It's like us, you know. It's our audience. And sometimes there'll be quite a few in there who are not our own kinfolk. And they have to laugh, you know. They're generally what we call overgood. They laugh at the serious parts for fear they won't be invited again. Then, too, it's not fair to a theater to be given a free show in competition to them. If an audience is going to be used, a charge should be made, and every cent of the proceeds go to an out-of-work actor's charity or some equally good cause. But I would suggest that one. But you all argue it out, and then you let me know, see? Now, wait a minute. Don't let me know. Don't send a letter. Don't send me any letters. I don't answer mail anyhow. Even if it's good mail, I don't even answer. A night letter to Mrs. Rogers when I'm flying in some distant country is about the extent of my correspondence anyhow. But you write to these folks that's putting on this racket. It's the Gulf Oil Company. I guess it's in care of the National, or is this Columbia? No, is it Columbia? No, this is a National. Here's an NBC right in front of me. NBC, nobody cares. And those are mighty good letters. Nothing anybody says over the radio today is remembered tomorrow, and it's just as well. Nobody cares. In fact, whatever you say tonight, you can come back on tomorrow night and deny it in case anybody does remember. But they don't. But it is the greatest thing in the world, and it's the greatest invention of our lifetime, and it's the only thing that I ever knew of. The radio is the only thing ever invented that didn't knock anybody out any worse. Having finished two pictures and a stage play and finally having caught a calf that I've been roping at between times all summer, I feel like I'm about ready to settle down and do a little steady work. So I'm taking my young with me and going to go clear around the world. I'm heading for Siberia by way of Honolulu, Japan, Manchuria, and then across the Trans-Siberian Railroad. That's 6,000 miles, longest railroad in the world. Say there's some planes flying, maybe take a plane or fly clear across there into Moscow and Leningrad. Then I'm going to find Finland. If Finland can go to the trouble of paying us, I certainly can go to take time out and try to find where they are.
If they're as honest as I think they are, I'm not going to book any further than there. I'm just going to stay there and run around with Nurmi. You know who Nurmi is? I'll ask your sporting writer. No, on second thought, you better not ask him either. He might not know. Well, then I'm going to Garboland. Going to Garboland and Norway and Minneapolis and Denmark. And Germany, weather permitting. The Rogers commission to Russia is composed of of old man Rogers and two hungry-looking sons. Mrs. Rogers accompanies us. She goes with us till the traveling gets rough and we run out of luxuries, and then we lose her. I think that's going to be the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo will be her last stand. Siberia and those wolves and those whiskers and those long names don't appeal to her. I've got a daughter, too, but she's working. In fact, that's how we're all able to make this trip, on account of her being working. If I run into Mr. Roosevelt over around Honolulu, maybe I can get him to go on with me. Say, wouldn't he be a great guy to travel around with, you know? He'd be wonderful, you know, just stop every once in a while and let him catch a fish, and it'll be all right, you know, and be in good humor and go on. If I can get him to travel with me all through Russia, he'll come back with more ideas than General Hugh Johnson and Rex Tugwell combined. This is it's a secret mission, and when I get back, the Senate will investigate me to see if they can find out why I went. It's a commission to end friendly relations between nations. All the others have been goodwill to us, and they have been so successful that no two nations are speaking to each other. You know, so mine I'm calling it a bad will to us. If we've got a friend anywhere, I'm going to see that he don't stay that way long. I'm going to impart facts to him, let him know just what we are. So, this war with Japan that a lot of our statesmen had already arranged for this past year, that seems kind of fallen down. I think I can get over there and hurry that on. Not a bit of reason why these two nations shouldn't be fighting right now. Kind of an off year, and most everybody's laying off. They have no reason to fight, so that's the best time to have a war. In fact, it's the only time they do have it. So I think if I get over there, I can kind of scare that up. My commission will be ready to report to the radio audience in October. Next October, I'll be back here and ready to talk to you. My report will be just as long and just as uninteresting as the Wickersham report was. Reason I'm going to travel so much in Russia and try to go all over Russia, down the Black Sea and all around, see those big experimental farms that farmers are supposed to be working on over there and all that. Reason I'm... You know, Russia today is... They're supposed to have the greatest experiment, be trying, the greatest experiment in the world, outside of us. So that's why I'm going over there. Now, remember, write to the Gulf Oil Company. Remember, write to them in care of the Democratic National Committee or the National Broadcasting, either one. And let us know whether... You know, whether you want to hear a lot of laughs and applause, whatever it is, anything you want. You're the boss, any way you want your radio and all. And goodbye and good luck to you. Hope you all have a fine summer, and I'm going to see you next... wait a minute. I wasn't through here yet. I'm going to see you next fall when I get back with a lot of news. Goodbye and good luck.
Will Rogers, from his broadcast of July the 8th, 1934, with a few views on his fellow radio comedians and plans for his Bad Will tour of the world. When he started his Gulf Show broadcasts in April 1933, he added one more element to his image, that alarm clock, which he set to go off when he needed to extricate himself from whatever stream of consciousness monologue he was delivering. He had his alarm clock with him on the 9th of June, 1935, as he addressed his Blue Network audience for the very last time that season.
Now here we go to Will Rogers and his famous alarm clock, broadcasting from Los Angeles, California.
Thank you. much. Much obliged. I feel kind of nervous today because my old friend Fred Stone is out in front, and I want to do a good throw for him. He's out here. He's got a great job out here in the movies now, playing Catherine Hepburn's pappy, you know? And boy, I'd like to get in one of those things with Katie. I wouldn't care where I played. I'd just like to get in there. I never did see her. Let's get a crack at that Mae West, too, if I could. Well, I got some good news for you all today. I mean, tonight. Maybe where you're listening to it, maybe it's dark. Out here, it's just in the middle of the afternoon. Something's the matter with this California weather. It's unusual. Sun shining today. Yep, quite a blow to all of us who live out here. You know, when a country gets so big that it's not the same time all over the country, it's too big. That it is. Here, a country shouldn't be so big, but we're at different times all over the place. We ought to split this country up anyhow. Let Republicans have the East, you know, you see. Let Republicans have all the East with Wall Street and then let them run it just like they want to, you know. And then the Democrats, they take the West, take Roosevelt, too, take him for a while. If he makes good, so don't we let him out, see. We just take him on trial, see. And we call it Roosevelt, see. Of course, we'd have to have put some initials to it to make him feel at home, you know. We couldn't just call it that. We'd have to have a lot of initials or something. He wouldn't know what to do without a lot of initials to juggle with. He could come out here in these broad spaces where he could try out pretty any plan he wanted, you know. And things just fell apart. Couldn't tell whether it was working or not. And then the beauty about him, if he was out here and the Democrats are all out here, is there's no Supreme Court to worry anybody. Because nobody on that court ever was west of the Mississippi River anyhow. And no Frank Kent or Mark Sullivan to bother him, and no New York Herald or Chicago Tribune to make life miserable for him. They're just, they got about the same standing out here those papers have as the Police Gazette. If a person wants to be a Republican, well, let him go east. And if he wants to be a Democrat, well, come west. And if he's not so hot about either party, well, let him go down to Louisiana. He can go down there with Huey, and he can share the cotton, and share the mule, and share the corn pone, and the pot liquor, and the chitlins, and everything, you know. And let Huey have the dissatisfied from both sides, then. Take the Army and Navy. Let either the East or the West have the Army and Navy, you know. Let one have the Army and the other one have the Navy, see? Then they never could fight. There wouldn't be any fight because the Army wouldn't have a boat and the Navy wouldn't have a horse or a ford. That way, you keep them fighting, I see. It's got some possibilities at that, you know. I know a lot of you will say we must preserve the Union, you know. You heard that, you know. But we must preserve the Union. Well, we say the Union is over-preserved right now. It's putting you in a pickle. But when Roosevelt comes west to take over the management of the Democrats, he's got to leave those professors back there. We're not going to let him bring any professors out here. He's got to come out on his own. Now, the Astor yacht, too, that thing, it don't fit in with Jeffersonian principles. A yacht is purely a Republican, too. If he wants to fish, he's always wanting to fish, trying to fish off that yacht. If he wants to fish, we'll give him a can of worms and let him go to Hoover Dam. Can you imagine a Democratic president sitting in there fishing in Hoover Dam? I don't know who the Republicans would have to run that country. I guess they'd run it like they do all their business with a board of directors, I suppose. The Republican don't feel good unless he's on the board of directors or something. Of course, they'd have all the money, but the Republicans would have all the money, but the Democrats would have all the fun. They'd have a lot of fun out here. All the rich Republicans, all the rich are Republicans, and they'd naturally go back east to be among people of their own standing. And then if the country split, that'd naturally do away with the national debt, see? That's what Russia did, you know, when it went under another government. Well, we split up with that to do with the debt, see? So both sides would start in owing nothing. And the Republicans would perhaps continue the same way, but the Democrats wouldn't take them long to dig up a deficit, and the Democrats could take whatever they're using for money, you know, and they could inflate or expand, or they'd use wampum or something, you know, and they could inflate or do anything they wanted to with it. And the Republicans say we should never gone off the gold. Well, then if they had their own country, well, they could go back on it if they want to. I can't picture a more ideal existence all around. The only trouble would be neither one would be happy because it wouldn't have nobody to lay anything on to, you know what I mean? Wouldn't have any other side to lay it on to. And so I doubt if the plan will ever get very far because this is not a time for common sense. But I started in to tell you all the good news for you that I'm off the air doing the heat spell. I was the first one of these broadcasting termites. A broadcaster, he's just like a termite. He gets in your house and you can't get him out every Sunday. Well, I was the first one to discover that an audience needed rest, you know. And I split all my broadcasting up kind of in doses. So I'm just going to let you find out your own way of settling the affairs of the world during the hot spell. I won't be able to advise you for about 2-3 months. I'm aiming to talk on the radio to an audience in warm weather. It kind of affects his mind and the audience's too. Heat and reason don't go together anyhow, you know. There's going to be a lot of spouting from the radio. I'm just warning you what you're going to get this summer. There's going to be a lot of spouting from the radio and from the speaker's platforms all this summer. There'll be more perspiration than common sense flowing. And the whole political thing has come now to a pretty direct division point. There's been a direct split in the party. Roosevelt thinks that while the Supreme Court was perfectly justified in what they did, he feels that the law should in some way allow certain injustices to be remedied. He thinks there should be a law saying how long you can work a man and the lowest sum that you can pay him. And the court says you can't do that. Well, that's a pretty big question. If there's no way of the underdog getting any assistance by law, why, things won't look any too rosy for the underdog. And, of course, the other side say we've got where we are as a great nation by this set of laws that we're living under. So why change them? Let the Constitution alone. And that's mighty good logic, too, I'm going to tell you. But here's something they forget. They can rightfully, you or I can rightfully say, we got where we are by these laws, but there's a lot of folks that haven't got anywhere under them, you know? And the prospects ain't any too bright for them to get any further. So they might not be averse to some small change in the Constitution. They might say, yes, give us what you got, and we'll say it's a perfect Constitution, too, see? So it all gets back to just how good has the Constitution been to you? That's all it is. It's just how good has it been to you? And nobody can answer that question but yourself. I would say that to the big majority, almost a unanimous majority, over a long course of years, it's been a mighty fine old document. And any person will think they're mighty serious before he'll vote for any change in the Constitution. But that's right. I'm going to go ahead and applaud, because I think that's fine good. That's fine. But that's, as I say, for every person to decide for themselves. You know how you know whether you've done better or not. You know better than any politician can come along and tell you. Even a doctor can't tell you what to do in a case like that. You don't know what you've ever done. So I think the thing has just got to be put to a straight out vote and an issue, and let it be put up to a vote and see what happens. Both sides want the country to be prosperous. It's not a political thing. Both sides want the country to be prosperous. It's just the difference of opinion in arriving at it.
is what they disagree on. Both sides, I think, are equally patriotic. Neither has a corner on patriotism, and neither has a corner on brains.
It's just, what should we do to recover? Now, the Republicans say that Roosevelt's schemes are all to reform somebody. Well, that's a good deal of truth in that. He wants to reform somebody. That's for him to let him recover first, and then they'll reform. See? They say if you'll let us get a little ahead, well, we'll reform. See? And Roosevelt wants to know why they can't reform first. See? Now, that's the whole thing in a nutshell. It was in a nutshell up to the time I just uttered it, and but yeah. Here's another way of putting it. Roosevelt wants recovery to start at the bottom. See what I mean? In other words, by a system of high taxes, he wants business to help the little fella to get started and get some work and then pay business back by buying things when he's at work. Business says, let everybody alone. Let business alone and quit monkeying with us and quit trying schemes and we'll get it, everything going for you. And as we prosper, naturally the worker will prosper. Now, that's exactly what business says, and they're justified from their angle in saying that. One wants recovery to start from the bottom, and the other wants it to start from the top. I don't know which is right. I've never heard of anybody suggesting that they might start it in the middle, so I hereby make that suggestion, you know? To start recovery halfway between the two, of course, it's the middle class that does everything anyhow. But I don't know anything about it, and that's why I'm resigning tonight and turning the whole situation over to Father Coughlin and Huey Long. And I, of course, during this hot weather, I don't want the blame of settling anything wrong, see, you know what I mean? Anyhow, I know things are going to get better in spite of both sides. When things do get better, then you'll hear the yell that will go up. Now, watch this, see? The Democrats will swear that recovery was due to them. Now, the Republicans, you see, on account of this late decision of the NRA, they'll say that it was due to them throwing out the NRA, see? So they both wanted to get in. Nobody wanted to claim the credit for the country blowing up. But wait till it starts picking up, and they'll both be in on it then, see? I don't think either one of them know what it's all about, to be honest with you. Both sides are doing nothing but just looking towards the next election. That's all they're doing anyhow. You don't hear anybody talk anymore about, wonder when these folks are going back to work, and what are they going to do about things picking up? All you hear now is, do you think Roosevelt will be elected, you know, and who will the Republicans run, you know? Shows you what the minds are on. The minds are on their own business. That's all it's on now. Well, they don't have to give a thought to that. If sentiment at that time is strong enough against Roosevelt, now get this, if sentiment at that time is strong enough against Roosevelt, why, the Republicans can nominate Shirley Temple and win with her. You know what I mean? In this country, people don't vote for, they vote against. You know that. You all know that. They don't vote for, they vote against. The vote was against Hoover. It was against Mr. Hoover. Well, no matter who was running, not taking anything away from Mr. Roosevelt, but the vote was against Mr. Hoover. And this year, it'll either be for or against Mr. Roosevelt. The other fellow won't cut any figure, no matter who it is running. The whole thing will depend on conditions. If things have picked up and are continuing to pick up right up to, we'll say, election time, well, the Republicans can hold. They can go ahead and hold that convention, but it'll be just for exhibition purposes only. I mean, and they can charge admission and take the money and send a candidate to nominate on a 4-year tour of the world or something, you know? On the other hand, now get this, on the other hand, if things are bad by next summer and fall, Roosevelt will get the blame, you know, without the Republicans or any opposition having a single, getting up and making any single speech. You won't have to do an ounce of denouncing at all. Nobody don't have to make speeches to bring these things about. They. The vote will go against Roosevelt. And the Republicans, then, in that case, the Republicans can nominate the night watchman of the convention and win with him. Don't matter who it is, you know? So all this talking and all this spouting and all the hard feelings and all the perspiration that's going to be smeared about all this summer will just be a total loss. Don't get all heated up and argue and get mad over these problems all summer, you know? Because I told you a while ago, conditions and not oratory is going to settle this next election. Everybody is trying to save the country, only they're trying to do it in different ways, and it's too big. The country's too big for all of them put together to spoil anyhow, see? So, goodbye, and I'll see you at your fall. Thank you very much.
Will Rogers never returned for the new season of the golf show that autumn of 1935. In August, he and pioneer aviator Wiley Post were